And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for close to 4 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Meet Mim. And then What Riley Wore. Where Are You From? That Flag. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with some Shel Silverstein poems from his book, Everything on It. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Meet Mim. Mim lives in the shallow, sandy waters where the roaring ocean meets the peaceful river. Mim is a brown spotted flatfish, gliding quietly along the soft, sandy seabed. No, wait! Mim is a spiked lionfish with strong colored bands and long venomous spines. No. She's a banded sea snake, sidewinding among the twisted, tangled tree roots. Oops, that's wrong too. She's a hermit crab, creeping carefully over sharp shells and slippery stones. Ah, I've got it. It looks like she's a jellyfish, floating freely with the fast-flowing current. No, she's not. She's an anemone, with her numerous arms swishing and swaying silently. Nope. She's a seahorse, daydreaming happily in among the weaving weeds. That's not it. I think Mim is a feather star, with her fine arms waving to and fro, fast then slow. Well, I was totally wrong. She's a stingray, with her long, slender tail trailing gracefully behind. That can't be right. Now it looks like she's a seashell, rocking and rolling restlessly with the moving tide. Ha! Got it! She's a mantis shrimp, her eyes bulging big and bright. Wait, where has she gone? Well, well. Mim is actually an octopus, a mimic octopus. And her favorite game is to fool everybody by looking like a flatfish, spiked lionfish, sea snake, hermit crab, feather star, jellyfish, stingray, sea anemone, seashell, seahorse, and mantis shrimp. What Riley Wore. On Monday, Riley wore a bunny costume because it was the first day of school and Riley felt shy. It was true that no one else in class wore a bunny costume. But it was also true that a girl who was crying asked if she could touch one of the ears. Riley said yes. The ears feel just like real velvet. On Tuesday, Riley wore a superhero cape to the dentist office because teeth cleaning is scary, and Riley wanted to be brave. The dentist said, "What's your superpower?" Riley said, "I'll have to get back to you on that." On Wednesday, Riley wore a ball gown out to dinner with Otto and Oma because they went to a fancy restaurant and ball gowns are the fanciest. When Riley spilled tomato soup, Oma used ginger ale to blot it out. A kid at another table said they should leave the stain just as it was because it looked like a star. And stars are cool. Thursday was Universe Day at school, so Riley decided that outer space jammies were the perfect thing to wear. Riley's teacher loved the jammies, and he asked Riley to stand on a chair while he pointed out the planets on Riley's back. Then everyone used scissors and glue and construction paper and made planets of their own. It rained on Friday, so Riley wore a colorful combination of rubber boots, a police officer jacket, and the world's best tutu. The crossing guard told Riley, "I had a pair of rain boots just like that when I was little." The recess captain, a big kid in the sixth grade, told Riley, "I like your tutu." When the weather turned mild on Saturday, Riley dressed in a hard hat and overalls to help Dad run errands. Three guys at the hardware store called Riley Daddy's little helper, and one of them gave Riley a sticker. Riley didn't peel it away from its backing because maybe it would make a good present for a friend someday. When they got home, Riley tucked the sticker away for safekeeping and wondered if being a friend could be a superpower. Sunday was a lazy home day. Riley spent part of it wearing nothing at all. But when Mom asked who wanted to go to the park, Riley put on one striped sock and one polka dot sock, purple jeans, the world's best tutu, a crazy monster shirt, red rubber boots, round aviator goggles, and a hat with dinosaur spikes. At the park, Riley felt shy. Then a kid from school walked up and asked, "Are you a girl or a boy?" Riley said, "Today, I'm a firefighter, and a dancer, and a monster hunter, and a pilot, and a dinosaur." "Oh," said the kid, "want to play?" "Yes." Then Riley reached into a pocket, pulled out the sticker, and gave it to the kid. The kid smiled, and Riley felt wonderful. Where are you from? "Where are you from?" they ask, and they're all a bunch of kids crowded around the swing set. "Is your mom from here? Is your dad from there?" they ask. "I'm from here, from today. Same as everyone else," I say. "No, where are you really from?" they insist. I ask Abuelo because he knows everything. And like me, he looks like he doesn't belong. "Where am I from?" Abuelo thinks. His eyes squint like he's looking inside his heart for an answer. "You come from the Pampas, the open, free land," he says. "You're from the Gaucho, brave and strong, from the brown river that cleanses and feeds the land, that gives us the grain for our bread, the milk from the cows. You're from mountains so high they tickle Señor Cielo's belly, where the condor roost his family and the jaguar prowls the night. But you're also from the warm blue oceans the copper warriors tried to tame, and the elegant palm trees stretch their fingers to caress. You're from hurricanes and dark storms, and a tiny singing frog that calls the island people home when the sun goes to sleep. From this land where our ancestors built a home for all, even when they were in chains because of the color of their skin. You're from the grandmothers who search for their grandchildren, waiting, always waiting in the plaza, their white handkerchiefs wrapping the sorrow of their thoughts. You come from the sunshine that lights our path in this world and the rain that washes away our mistakes. But Abuelo, I ask, where am I really from? Abuelo laughs. Do you want a place? He points to his heart. You're from here, from my love and the love of all those before us. From those who dreamed of you because of a song sung under the Southern Cross, or the words in a book written under the light of the North Star. You are from all of us. I am. That flag. And here's a picture of two girls. One is white and the other is black. Bianca and I are almost twins. We're the same in so many ways. We both wear our hair in braids. We spend independent reading time together. We play Foursquare better than anyone in our class. We're inseparable. She's my best friend. But only at school. I'm not allowed to go to her house, even though we live on the same street. Kira, Mom says whenever I go outside, please stay where I can see you. Then she shoots a look that means don't go anywhere near their yard. I know why. It's because of that flag. And it's the Confederate flag. Mom and Dad say it's a hate flag, a symbol of violence and oppression. Bianca's parents told her it's a heritage flag, a celebration of courage and pride. What I know is I can't go to any parties or sleepovers at her house, and I can't invite her to mine. At bedtime, before my parents tuck me in, I remember my field trip form. It's for the Southern Legacy Museum, Dad says. They have a new exhibit. Mind if I tag along? I don't mind. Dad is a lot of fun. He even buys me souvenirs sometimes. Sure, I say. Mom and Dad hug me tight for an extra long time. On field trip day, once we're off the bus, Bianca and I link hands. We wait for Ms. Grayson to call our names. Oh no, she's assigned us to different groups. When I start to frown, Dad tugs my braids, makes a face, and smiles. I can't help but smile back. I'm glad Dad's here with me. After walking around for a while, we see a red, white, and blue sign, Stars and Bars. Dad takes my hand. This is something we need to see. First, we see a frilly dress from antebellum days. I picture myself wearing it and giggle. I'd look pretty silly. There's a cotton gin with lots of little puffy plants around it. Wish we could pick some off, I say. Dad glances but doesn't say anything. When we come to an auction block, Dad freezes. He's not smiling at all. Neither am I. In silence, Dad and I walk to a glass case filled with old photographs. I see soda fountains, poodle skirts, gigantic cars with fins, dogs and water hoses, teenagers crying in the streets, scary men in white gowns, holding torches and flags. That flag, the Confederate flag. Kira, Bianca runs up to me. I've been looking for you everywhere. She throws her arms around my neck, but I don't hug her back. What's wrong? She asks. My throat feels tight. I'm not sure what to say. I just point to the picture in the case. Then I walk away. Back on the bus, Dad and I sit up front behind the driver. I stare out the window, remembering those pictures and that flag. My best friend's flag. Later that night, my family and I talk for a long time. They tell me things they've never told me about before. About the scary things my grandpa saw when he was just a kid. About grandma being spat on for trying to go to school. About mom and dad getting called back names, getting called bad names, and chased by people in a truck. About the Freedom Riders. About Selma. About the Charleston Nine. We talk about the things black people have to do every day to stay safe. After our talk, I feel scared, confused, and mad. But mostly, I'm sad. At school the next day, I wait for Bianca to say something about the pictures. She talks about her puppy instead. I guess those pictures didn't bother her. I guess we're not the same. I guess we're not best friends, after all. During reading time, I read by myself. At recess, I jump rope alone. When Miss Grayson asks what we learned from our field trip, I say the Confederate flag is racist. That's not true, Bianca cries. It stands for Southern pride. The Confederacy, Miss Grayson says, fought a war to keep black people enslaved. Their battle flag is still used by hate groups who want white people to rule. No, Bianca shakes her head. Why would my family fly a flag like that? I don't know, Miss Grayson answers, but it's a good question to ask. I'm trying to beat my grandpa at chess when I hear Grandma cry, "Lord have mercy." Mom turns up the news. It's news none of us wants to hear. Two black people were shot in their own front yard by three white men. They show pictures of the men on TV. They're standing in front of that flag. That hate flag. My family and I go to a candlelight vigil to honor the couple that was killed. I look at the crowd. I can't believe my eyes. Bianca and her parents are here. I did not expect her family to come. I wonder why they did. Coming home, we see a new house flying that flag. It makes my heart hurt, so I look away. We pass Bianca's house. They've taken theirs down. I can't stop staring. I wonder why they did. As the late bell rings the next morning at school, Bianca passes me a note. You were right. I haven't spoken to Bianca for days. No sharing books or playing foursquare at recess. But now, that flag is gone from her house. So maybe things can be different. Maybe we can be friends after all. I don't know. But I'm willing to see. And it shows her going over to her house. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour with some poems written by Shel Silverstein from his book titled Everything on It. Jimmy Jack John. Oh, where are you going, my Jimmy Jack John? With only the moon for your light? I'm going round in search of the dawn. and I'll probably be gone most of the night. Oh, why are you crying, my Jimmy Jack John? And why do you stare out to sea? I'm thinking that over the waves of the pond, the dawn lies awaiting for me. But why do you wander, my Jimmy Jack John, a roaming in search of the blue? Just wrap yourself tight in this blanket of night, and the dawn will come to you. Housebroken. The puppy's housebroken at last. Lord only knows he was needin' it. You've trained him to go on the newspaper? Fine, but please, not while I'm reading it. Wrong way. This is not what I asked for. This is not what I planned. When I said, okay, you can bury me up to my neck in the sand, and it shows his head under the sand. The clock man. How much will you pay for an extra day? The clock man asked the child. Not one penny, the answer came, for my days are as many as smiles. How much will you pay for an extra day? He asked when the child was grown. Maybe a dollar or maybe less, for I've plenty of days of my own. How much will you pay for an extra day? He asked when the time came to die. All of the pearls in all of the seas and all of the stars in the sky. Slam dunker. Short guys can play basketball. You really don't have to be 7 feet tall. If you've got the want to, and you've got the try, and you've got a basket that's 4 feet high. The pelican. Picking big fish from the seas, the pelican can do with ease. But picking up a tiny ant is something that a pelican can't. Trampoline. Bouncing upon the trampoline so high above the ground, just as I was going up, I saw her coming down. She had a daisy in her hair. She wore a silken gown. But when she started going up, I was coming down. I tried to say, hello, nice day. She smiled and spun around. Come up a while with me, yelled she. But I was going down. And so, as yet, we've never met, because we've sadly found that one is always going up while one is coming down. My hat. Some wear berets and some wear fedoras. Some like sombreros a lot. Some prefer capes with those, or caps with those floppity flaps and those little propellers on top. Some wear fancy high hats, and some like the kind that's got duck bills or Mickey Mouse ears. But why is it that when I put on my hat, everyone just disappears? The Dance of the Shoes. Were you there for the Dance of the Shoes when they skipped in a column of twos? From the closet they crept, and they jumped, skipped, and leapt, doing the dance of the shoes. And the high heels clicked, and the football cleats kicked, and the sandals flip-flopped, and the clogs clipped and clopped, and the button shoes creaked, and the sneakers just sneaked, and the baby shoes skipped, and the slippers both slipped, and the ballet shoes jumped, and the hunting shoes clumped. They started at 7 and danced until 10, when they all tiptoed back to the closet again. Oh, the dance of the shoes! Now they stand in a row, looking proper and right, and acting just like they've been there all night. Investigating. Professor Shore from Memphis State decided to investigate just how the elephant's tail was tied onto the elephant's leathery hide. Well, while he was investigating, something happened so nauseating and so disgusting that I fear it just might make you sick to hear it. So let's just say Professor Shore doesn't investigate tails no more. You'll find surprises happen mostly when we investigate too closely. In her long mink coat and her buckskin pants and her lizard skin boots with the rattlesnake bands and her beaver hat with the raccoon tails, we heard her shouting, "Save the whales." He tried to hide. He dreamed of a glunk with a horrible face and thought he'd better hide someplace. He tried to hide between the sheets and found an ogre with two left feet. He tried to hide in the dresser drawer and heard a hungry tiger roar. He tried to hide beneath the bed and found a body without a head. He tried to hide behind the door and heard a sleeping monster snore. He tried to hide down in the basement and found a dragon to his amazement. He tried to hide beneath the stair and found a mummy grinning down there. He tried to hide behind the drapes and found a dozen hairy apes. He tried to hide behind a dresser and found a murdering mad professor. He tried to hide in a pile of clothes and found a witch with a warty nose. He tried to hide under the sink and found a vampire taking a drink. He tried to hide in the garbage pail and found a werewolf sharpening his nails. So he went back to bed, that's what he did, and he dreamed of tomorrow, and there he hid. Holding. We can't hold hands, someone might see. Won't you please hold toes with me? Why I'm screaming. The dentist tried to pull my tooth out. He pulled, but couldn't get the root out. He pulled that tooth right out the door. He pulled it down to Baltimore. He took the train to Hackensack. He booked a plane to Fond du Lac. He hitched a ride to Santa Fe. He hired a guide to San Jose. He swam across the Windsor Straits. He zipped through Maine on roller skates. He pulled a raft down Frenchman's Creek. He bounced through Nome on a pogo stick. He sailed a boat through Puget Sound. He rode a goat through Provincetown. And now he's pedaling through Duluth, still pulling on that stubborn tooth. And he's charging me all the while, not by the tooth, but by the smile. Tic-tac-toe. Let's play tic-tac-toe. I'll take the X's. You take the O. Sticking a tack in someone's toe is not the way to play, you know. Frightened. There are kids underneath my bed, cried little baby monster Fred. Mama monster smiled. Oh, Fred, there's no such thing as kids, she said. Losing pieces. Talked my head off, worked my tail off, cried my eyes out, walked my feet off, sang my heart out. So you should see, there's really not much left of me. Horn. It's a highly unusual horn. I bought it from Hustlin' Paul. He said if I practice 5 minutes a day, I'll be great in just no time at all. And soon I'll give concerts for princes and kings, playing as sweet as the nightingale sings, as soft as the snow falls, as clear as the rain, as loud as the wild winds of winter. And they'll all love my music once I figure out which end of this thing you blow enter. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 4 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect, magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week, Russell's dad's lawyer, CJ, was quizzing Darcy about putting Russell in a compromising situation, only to sue Russell's family because Russell's dad is the lead singer for her favorite band, the Nighthawks, which she never knew until now. CJ asked Darcy to sign a disclosure agreement or be held accountable for everything that happened at the hotel swimming pool. Eventually, she signed it and left the compound alone, but without her duffel bag, but a charged phone. When she turns around to get her tent, she runs into Russell, who tells her the swimming pool incident was all her fault, and he was the one that saved both of them from going to jail. And that's where we left off last week. "The pool was your idea," he said, all in a rush. "You were the one who suggested breaking into it. You were the one who wanted to swim. So this is my fault? Oh, did I not make that clear? Of course it is. Who else's fault would it be, Darcy?" I swallowed hard, feeling my cheeks flame. "Okay, fine. But you could have said no. You do have some choice in this matter. You didn't have to go along with it, you know." "Well, I did, because I liked you." It was like we both heard the past tense at the same time, and I knew that it shouldn't have bothered me. I was leaving. I never wanted to see this guy again. But that didn't change the fact that it did. "Well, then, I'm so sorry. Clearly, this is all my fault. What was I thinking? And I'm so grateful for your celebrity dad and his millions of dollars and his lawyers coming in to rescue us. Thank you so much." I spat out the last word. Russell nodded, folded his arms, and looked away. I folded my arms, too. I was breathing hard, already regretting some of the things I'd said. "Right," he finally said, his tone cool. "Sure. I just want to go home." "So what's stopping you?" It was like Russell was trying to sound tough, but not quite pulling it off. "Well, my stuff has disappeared, and I don't know where I am or how to get out of here." "Your things are in the house," he said, nodding down the path. "And if you want to leave, we can get you a car in Vegas. But you could also houses." The phrase seemed to hang in the air between us for a moment, and he must have heard it too, because the tips of his ears turned red and he looked down at the ground. That's not necessary. I decided I was going to be formal and businesslike and just get through this. It was the same way I'd handed any conversation I'd had to have with Gillian in the run-up to school starting. Fine, Russell said, matching my tone. Fine. This way. He pointed toward the house and started walking down the path. He was striding fast, not slowing down or waiting for me, like I knew he would have done earlier tonight. But who cared? I didn't need him to wait for me. In fact, the faster we got to the house, the faster I could get out of there. But as we got closer, I slowed, then stopped short, shock piercing the red fog of my anger. And it wasn't like I'd never seen nice houses before. We lived in Los Angeles, the land of impressive homes. But I'd never quite seen anything like this. The garage looked more like an airplane hangar. The house itself seemed to sprawl on as far as I could see. It was a mix of dark wood, steel, and glass, like a cabin crossed with a super modern house. But somehow it worked. It was, above all, impressive. The kind of house that was designed, even though there was nothing gaudy about it, to let you know just how wealthy and important the owner was. Russell walked toward the front door, still not waiting for me or looking to see if I was behind him. I hurried to keep pace, but then stopped short and just blinked at what was before me. There was a Jeff Koons balloon dog on the lawn, 15 feet high, purple and reflecting the moonlight and the lights that lined the driveway. The Broad Museum in downtown L.A. had put on a Koons exhibit last year, and my dad and I had gone. We'd both loved the balloon dogs the best, but I had never seen his work outside of a museum. Until this moment, it hadn't occurred to me that you could own something like this. Art that was also in museums, the stuff that everyone else only got to look at for a few moments. But some people got to have it and see it whenever they wanted. For just a second, I thought about our house in Raven Rock, the way that I could see the neighbors from my bedroom windows, the way that my dad and I would sit on the front steps in the morning and wave to all the dog walkers and runners passing by. The creaky stairs and uneven floors, the slightly peeling paint my dad kept promising to get touched up, but never actually did. Nobody was ever going to put it on the cover of a magazine. And the closest we'd ever come to having lawn art was when we put out Boney, our Halloween skeleton. And as I tore my gaze away from the priceless art and climbed the front steps to stand next to Russell, but not too close, I was getting angry and embarrassed all over again. I'd talked to him about loans and trouble paying for college, assuming we were somewhat on the same page. Standing on the threshold of a mansion, I felt just how stupid I'd been. Russell reached out and knocked on the door. I went to Silverspun with my dad, he explained after a moment, so I don't have my keys. That was the friend you went with? Russell gave a short nod, and I realized the fight he'd mentioned must have been with his dad. But I wasn't about to give him the satisfaction of asking any follow-ups. Russell sighed and knocked again harder this time. Come on, he muttered. Isn't that a doorbell, I asked, nodding toward it, trying to move things along. After all, this house was huge, and the door was probably made of 3 feet thick reclaimed oak or whatever. Yeah, It's embarrassing. He winced, then pressed the doorbell. And the first verse of Darcy started playing. Darcy, tell me why. A love song ain't nothing but a lie. It was much louder than normal doorbells. Wow. Yep. Only a little while ago, I would have made a joke about how it was playing my song. But that moment was over. So I just looked straight ahead and made my plan. Surely Kendrick or Bella or someone would answer the door, and I'd grab my stuff and leave. If I was lucky, I could be heading for the Vegas bus station in under 10 minutes. And then this night and everything I'd gone through would finally be over. It could move to the past tense, as opposed to something I was still in the middle of, struggling to get my bearings. I took a breath, about to suggest Russell ring the bell again, when the door was flung open. So, I blinked at the man who'd opened the door. He was barefoot and dressed in all black. Black jeans, black leather belt, black cashmere Henley. He had on a huge, chunky silver watch and rings on four of his fingers. He had long silver hair and was taller than I'd expected. Wiley Sanders was standing in front of me. Chapter 10, Sunday, 10:30 p.m. I stared at him. It was like it took my brain a minute to click into gear. I'd seen images of this man my whole life, on album covers and magazines, in retrospective documentaries and music videos. I'd seen him on TV, at award shows, and at halftime shows at the Super Bowl. I'd seen him hours ago. How was that possible? On stage at Silverspun. But until this moment, I'd never been just 4 feet away from him, with him looking back at me. Katie had gone down a bit of the rabbit hole last fall when she was working on a project for AP Psych about how our brains aren't wired for celebrities. She'd explained that for most of human history, if you saw someone a lot, it meant they were in your village or tribe or whatever, and you knew them. And that, in our brains, frequency builds affection. So that when we've seen pictures of celebrities for years and years, our brains code them as someone we know, as a friend, when in actuality, they're total strangers. I was feeling that now in real time, standing on the doorstep as my mind tried to grapple with seeing Wiley Sanders close up. In person, he looked older than I was expecting, which made sense, since I was pretty sure he was in his 60s. Part of me, the part that Katie had talked about, was like, oh, you know him. And the other, more rational part was like, holy fuck, that's Wiley Sanders. We all just stood there for a moment, and then Wiley, Mr. Sanders, reached out and pulled Russell into a tight hug. I was so mad, Wiley Sanders said while hugging his son. I could see that Russell was hugging him back. He tugged on the back of Russell's hair, and then they stepped apart. Don't do that again. You can't just leave like that. We were losing our minds, but I'm so glad you're okay. He smiled at his son, but this only lasted a second before it morphed into a frown. But then you're getting arrested, and now I'm mad all over again. He cupped Russell's face in his hands, kissed his cheek, then shook his head and sighed. I looked between them, trying to process this, the warmth and worry and love that were as plain as anything on Wiley's impossibly famous face. This was not the Wiley Sanders I'd been expecting to see. Wiley slung an arm around Russell's shoulders. We're going to have a talk, kiddo. Russell looked at his sneakers. A storm of emotion was crossing over his face. Relief, anger, embarrassment. I didn't know what had happened with his dad, what their fight was about, or how Russell had even ended up in a bus station in the first place. But whatever was going on, I knew my being there to see it was making things worse. Then, Wiley Sanders turned to me and smiled, and it was like I could practically feel a charm offensive coming at me, like stage lights were clicking on one by one, bathing me in warmth. "And you must be Darcy." He seemed to twinkle when he said my name and touched a hand to his heart in faux humility. "After my song, I presume." He said this like he was setting up a punchline, like he expected me to say, "No, it was from my grandmother," or "I was named because of Pride and Prejudice," or "My parents just liked it." I swallowed quickly before speaking. My words were caught against my throat. Yes, actually. Some of the practiced charm slipped a little bit, and a more surprised, genuine smile emerged. "Really?" I nodded. "My dad, he's a really big fan, so he named me after the song." I took a breath and made myself say it, since I was very sure I wouldn't ever get this chance again. "I am, too, a big fan. I mean..." He grinned, a totally genuine smile this time, big and a little dorky, and one I had never seen in any of his pictures or videos. "Really? That's great." He jostled Russell. His arm was still around his son's shoulders. "See? Some kids your age like your dad's music." Okay, Russell said. The tips of his ears, I could see, were starting to turn red again. "All right," Wiley Sanders said. He lifted his arm off Russell's shoulders and clapped his hands together. They made a metallic clicking sound, probably because of all the rings. I noticed that he was also wearing an impressive number of necklaces, a silver chain, and what looked like an enormous shark tooth on a leather cord, and a tiny dagger-looking thing encrusted with diamonds. "Let's go in and get all this sorted. Everything go okay with CJ." Russell shook his head. "Not really. She was pretty aggressive, and I think she crossed some lines." He glanced at me for a moment, then looked away again. "She was really unfair to Darcy." Wiley's face fell, and he winced. "I'm so sorry, Darcy. CJ sometimes forgets we're not opposing counsel. I'll have to talk with her, okay?" I nodded, even though I wasn't sure if he actually meant any of this. It was his job to be charming, after all, and his lawyer's job to make sure the machine keeps running. He stepped inside the house, gesturing for us to follow, pushing the door open wider, giving me a smile. "Darcy, please come in. I'm sure you're tired. And then I need to hear what happened at this hotel. And maybe one of you can explain to me why I'm apparently playing some kind of corporate retreat next month. And we should get some food in both of you. Priya's making some penny, and you're both just in time for fishbowl." I wasn't sure what most of that meant, but before I could ask or pluck up my courage to tell him that actually I wouldn't be doing any of that since I was about to leave, a brown and white bullet shot past me, brushing against my leg. It was a small dog, moving faster than I'd seen a dog move before. Its legs were practically a blur. It took the three steps in a leap, seeming to hang in the air for just a moment before hitting the lawn and tearing across it. "Oh, for fuck's sakes, Andy!" Wiley Sanders yelled. Russell dropped his backpack and ran after the dog. And after only a second's hesitation, I did the same, dropping my canvas bag and running after him. I hadn't gotten far before Russell reached the dog, Andy. He scooped him up and started walking him back to the house. I'd expected the dog to struggle, try to get away. He had been very intent on leaving, but his stub of a tail just wagged furiously, and he tried to stretch up to lick Russell's face. He was a small dog, probably 10 or 12 pounds, with curly brown and white fur and a black nose. His ears flopped over, but it also seemed like he could lift them up like he was doing now as he looked up at Russell beseechingly, as though asking why a belly rub wasn't happening. He was, in short, very cute. I turned and headed back to the house too, which was when I saw Wiley had gone inside, and my bag and Russell's backpack had both disappeared. I didn't understand why, at this place, my possessions were constantly disappearing. Russell stepped inside and gestured me in. "Shut the door," he nodded down at the dog in his arms. "Otherwise, he'll try to get out again." "Right." Russell's voice was clipped and tense. I tried to remind myself that was how I resolved to talk to him as well. And I shouldn't be upset that he was doing this too. Only after the door was shut did Russell put Andy down. The dog shook himself once, a full body shake, then trotted off. Russell glanced at me and frowned. "Are you okay?" I said. My eyes were wide as I tried to take everything around me. I was attempting to play it cool, but apparently I wasn't pulling it off. We were in the entranceway of Wiley Sanders' house, but whereas my house foyer, if you could even call it that, was the place where we kicked off shoes and dropped bags and keys and coats, this was different. The ceilings were incredibly high, and I needed to tilt my head back almost all the way to see up to the top. But that wasn't what I was staring at. It was the art. There was a Picasso across from me. A Picasso. It was hung on the wall, with no glass or anything, just the canvas in a wood frame. I automatically looked to the side of it for the little white plaque that would give me the name and date of the painting, but of course it wasn't there, because this was someone's house. There was a mobile hanging from the impossibly high ceiling, turning slowly this way and that. It was the kind I'd seen in museums before, even though I didn't know the name of the artist. But the most difficult thing to look away from wasn't the Picasso or the mobile. It was the portrait right in front of me. I didn't think this was an artist I was supposed to know, despite the fact that it was hung next to what I was pretty sure was a Kendall Wiley. It was an oil painting and huge, well over 6 feet. It looked like the kind of painting I'd seen on the covers of old paperback sci-fi novels. Wiley Sanders was depicted standing shirtless on some kind of desert planet. There were three moons and a sun behind him, at any rate. He was raising a sword above his head in triumph, with long hair blowing in the wind. There was a blonde girl in some kind of desert bikini thing pressed up against his well-oiled torso as a spaceship rose into the air behind them. "Yeah," Russell said, seeing where I was looking at. "Right. My stepmother had that commissioned. Ex-stepmother now," he shrugged. "We've all just gotten used to it." Oh, I forced myself to look away, even though it was challenging. I glanced around the foyer, but didn't see my canvas bag anywhere, to say nothing of my tent or duffel. The last thing I wanted was to need anything from Russell, even information. But it didn't seem like I had a choice. I folded my arms and took a breath. Do you know where my stuff is? No idea. Probably inside. His voice was still cold, chilled all the way through. He shook his head. I'll see if I can track it down. And with that, he walked inside the house and left me alone. I hesitated for a moment. Was I supposed to wait for Russell to come back with it or follow him? Was I really supposed to wander around a rock star's house? But I needed my stuff back, and I didn't see any other way to make that happen. It's okay, Dee Dee's voice was surprisingly gentle. It's almost over. Just get your stuff and you can leave. I pushed my shoulders back and walked into the next room, but I wasn't sure if room was the right word, since it seemed to be basically the whole bottom floor of the house, just without any dividing rooms or doors. The kitchen, enormous, with two islands and no visible refrigerators, flowed into a dining area, which became a huge TV room. The TV room had a fireplace, lots of chairs, a coffee table, and was ringed with an enormous, squashy, sectional couch. There was more impressive art on the walls, but there were also family pictures, portraits, and candids and Polaroids hung up right next to the Rothkos. I could see Russell standing off to the side of the room, talking to a dark-haired woman in her 20s who was holding an iPad. In addition to them, there were a lot of people in this house. There was a big group sitting around a massive dining table, which was right in front of floor-to-ceiling glass windows. And through the sliding glass doors, I could see the backyard and a huge pool glowing with soft, subtle lights. And unfortunately, this is all the time that we have for today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.